Coming up next, please join us for Real Israel Talk Radio. This is episode 126.
Shalom once again. I'm Avi Ben-Mordechai. Welcome to Real Israel Talk Radio. This is podcast episode 126 and a part 13 analysis of Yeshua's last Passover week timeline of events leading to his crucifixion and his third day resurrection. Now, in my previous analysis, podcast episode 125 and part 12 in this program series, I walked you through event number 9 of the 27 events that I have identified as part of the major actions shaping the last week of Yeshua's earthly ministry, eventually resulting in his crucifixion on the fifth day of the week in what we would refer to as a Thursday. Let's now go on to event number 10, setting up the Aviv 14 Passover story of Yeshua and his betrayal by Yehuda or Judas, based on the story of Joseph in Egypt. 2 points I want to make here. Number one, according to the time reckoning of the Tzedok solar calendar, it is now around the evening sunset of the third day of the week, on what we would call a Tuesday of the Hebrew Chodesh 1 and the 14th day of that Chodesh, which is the month of Aviv. And this is based on the Tzedok declaration of the new year, which took place 13 days previously on the fourth day of the week at sunrise, on what we would call Wednesday sunrise to Thursday sunrise. And the second point that I want to make, according to the time reckoning of the Judean Pharisaic sighted moon calendar, this is also the Hebrew Chodesh or new month number 1. But the date is the start of Nisan or Aviv 12. This is based on the Sanhedrin religious court announcement that Rosh Chodesh, or what they would call the new moon, was officially announced 12 days previously at sunset in Jerusalem on what we would call a Thursday at sunset. So essentially what I'm saying is that the difference between the Tzedok solar calendar and the Judean Pharisaic sighted moon calendar, it was a difference of 2 days between those two calendars. This being said, let us now go on to read from Matthew 26, verses 20 through 23, which also appears in the Gospel of John, chapter 13, and verse 26. When evening had come, he sat down with the 12. Now, as they were eating, he said, "Assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." And they were exceedingly sorrowful, and each of them began to say to him, "Master, is it I?" He answered and he said, "He who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me." As I read through this narrative several times, I took it at face value, a kind of what you see is what you get story. Here, someone reclining around the Passover table will betray Yeshua. Whom will it be? So Yeshua dipped his hand into a dish on the Passover table and then gave a small fragment of what he had dipped to Yehuda or Judas. Now, we could take this at face value, and in doing so, there would be nothing more to see here. But then again, I thought to myself, wait a moment, there must be something else going on here, a deeper lesson. It appeared odd to me why Yeshua would choose this special, particular dipping action to reveal his betrayer. So I asked myself the question, why do it that way? Why not reveal the betrayer in a more straightforward way? In other words, tell it like it is, right? But Yeshua did and said many things that had deeper connotations to them. And so I began looking for hidden clues in the narrative. However, what I do not want to do is read something into the story that may not be there. I admit, I am a storyteller. I'm a story narrator. And embellishing event details is certainly not beyond me. The danger is that of reading things into a biblical text, which is called eisegesis, or perhaps, in some cases, just good old-fashioned storytelling with a twist. Nonetheless, I want to share with you some speculative thoughts about what I think might be going on just below the surface. Okay? Since the very night of this particular narrative was the real biblical Passover of the Torah, that is, the 14th of the month Aviv on the priestly Tzedok calendar, it appears meaningful and quite suggestive that Yeshua chose to reveal the identity of his betrayer with the narrative telling us, quote, and having dipped the bread, he gave to Judas Iscariot, or Yehuda, the son of Shimon, in John 13:26. The sheer fact of mentioning a dipping on the night of Passover specifically conveys to us that Yeshua is retelling the story of the Passover by focusing on the cause that led to the ceremony of Passover to begin with. You see, when consulting numerous generations of Judean Passover storytelling traditions, you will always find a logical beginning that addresses the national redemption theme of Exodus 6, 6 through 7, and Exodus chapter 13, verse 14. Let me read them to you together. Therefore, say to the children of Israel, I am Yehovah. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from their bondage. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm, and with great judgment, I will take you as my people, and I will be your Elohim, or your God. So it shall be when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is this? That you will say to him, Bechozek Yad, in strength of hand, Yehovah brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. The Passover Haggadah, which is a written order of service, guides and facilitates the retelling of the Passover story. Traditionally, using today's Jewish Orthodox standards, the Passover Seder, which means simply the order of the service, begins with a cup of wine and a kiddush to set apart the night. Then the Seder progresses to Urchatz, which is the washing of the hands. The next thing to follow is Karpas, the dipping of a green herb or vegetable, like parsley or celery, into salt water or vinegar, and then saying a blessing. What follows next is Yachatz, that is the breaking of the middle of three pieces of matzah or unleavened bread from what is called the afikomen. Then what follows this action is the all-important Magid, the Passover story retold, and this includes the eating of maror, something bitter. The retelling of the Passover story always includes Ma'anishtanah, the opening of each of four questions that a child asks, saying, "What makes this night different from all other nights?" The answers lead everyone into the lengthy narrative of our Egyptian slavery and all that happens to the nation for generations afterward. In the late Second Temple period of first century Judaism, this specific order of service is pretty much the way a Passover Seder was conducted. And today, it pretty much continues to be done in the same way. Yeshua, however, appears to have established his own style of service, beginning the Passover Seder with a kazait, or a tiny olive-sized morsel of a bitter vegetable, such as parsley or celery, dipped into a red wine vinegary substance. This is called karpas, and it is referred to in John 13:26, when Yeshua said concerning the one who would betray him, "It is he to whom I shall give a kazait, or a tiny morsel of a vegetable, when I have dipped," referring to the karpas, "and having dipped the morsel," meaning the morsel of karpas, a vegetable fragment, "he gave to Yehuda Iscariot, the son of Shimon." I do not believe that the Passover morsel or fragment of John 13:26 was bread, as one might think or assume, because first of all, the word bread does not even appear there. It is added by translators, assuming that the text needs some clarification. The Greek word in that passage of John 13:26 says that it was a morsel or a fragment, but it doesn't tell us of what. But based on today's Jewish Orthodox Passover tradition, that morsel would be a green herb or a piece of a vegetable. In Yeshua's day, it was the very same idea, a tiny morsel or a fragment of a green herb or vegetable. Now, this dipping of a green herb or vegetable morsel is then followed by yachatz, that is the breaking of the middle of three pieces of matzah or unleavened bread belonging to what is called the afikomen, which is a reference to what Yeshua said in Matthew 26:26. And as they were eating, Yeshua took bread, blessed and broke, and gave to the disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." After this part of the ceremony, it appears that he went on to the next step of the Passover Seder, called Magid, a reciting and retelling of the Passover story. But unlike the Judeans of his day, who always started the Passover story with Abraham descending down into Egypt, resulting in generations of harsh slavery affecting the nation for a couple of centuries afterward, the Passover Seder of Yeshua seems to have taken a more novel approach compared to the Seder of the Judeans. And this is what I would like to show in his opening statement to his disciples when he said, quote, "He who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me." In other words, Yeshua fundamentally said, "The betrayer is someone very close to me." Now let us talk about the Passover tradition of dipping. The practice of dipping implies that Yeshua was bringing to memory a betrayal event involving Joseph, because in Hebrew, the dipping of a green herb or vegetable, tet, vet, lamed, taval, is in fact found in Genesis 37:31 in the story of Joseph's coat of colors. In the Greek of John 13:26, the model or notion of dipping is related in meaning to the LXX Septuagint word for dipping in Genesis 37:31. In other words, the Greek terms are not exactly the same, but they do both express the same idea of dipping or immersion. As Joseph was betrayed by those who were very close to him, so another betrayal was now in progress again. But this time, it's a betrayal from one who was very close to Yeshua and, in fact, traveled within his inner circle. It is within this context of the Magid of the Passover unfolds, and unfold it did, leading to a national enslavement of the Hebrews, which led to the reason for the Passover redemption in the first place. Yeshua then concluded his story with the redemption theme of Exodus chapters 12 and 13. All this looks to be how the house of Tzedok told the Passover story, unlike the Judeans, who essentially skipped over the problem of the retelling of the betrayal of Joseph and instead went straight to the lesson of the Passover redemption and the Hebrew nation's hope. In other words, the Judean Seder was and is, even today, more focused on those evil Egyptians and not on those evil brothers of Joseph, because that might just be way too uncomfortable. This said, let's now enter into some interesting Passover Seder speculation. Again, for Yeshua, it appears that the Passover story starts with an allusion to Genesis chapter 37, when Jacob's son Joseph wore the garment of a favored firstborn son. According to the story, he was sold to some Midianites and Ishmaelites, clearly facilitated by Joseph's brothers, who obviously had a hand in the matter. Those merchants brought Joseph down to Egypt to be sold on the slave market. I'll come back to explain more about this and Joseph's betrayal connection in a moment. But first, let's talk a little bit about Joseph's brothers. They hated him for his dreams and, in fact, said to him in Genesis 37:8, "Shall you indeed have kingship over us? Or shall you indeed be an example over us?" They're referring to a moral or spiritual example. So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. The Genesis 37 narrative picks up on the story that the brothers of Joseph took their father's flock to go and feed them in the Shechem area, which is today's Arabic town of Nablus in north-central Israel. Subsequently, they decided to go further north and take the flock of sheep to some better grazing grounds in the area of Dothan, which today is known as Tel Dothan or Bir al-Basha, about 10 kilometers drive southwest of the city of Jenin. In the meantime, as time passed, Jacob sent his son Joseph to travel north to check on the welfare of his brothers. When he arrived in the area, his brothers wanted nothing to do with him, and in fact, they were more than happy to be rid of him as soon as possible. We learn this from Genesis 37:18 through 19. Now, when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, "Ah, look, this dreamer is coming." Well, they bullied him, abused him, and in Genesis 37:23, they stripped Joseph of his tunic. It's called the tunic of colors that was on him. Then they threw him into a pit, saying in Genesis 37:20, "We shall see what will become of his dreams." More time passes, and they entertained some second thoughts about laying their hands on him. So instead of killing him, they considered returning him to their father. But then we learn this in Genesis 37:25 through 28. They lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come on, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, and don't let our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened. Then some Midianite merchants, likely among the Ishmaelites, took Joseph, lifted him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Then after this, Joseph became the slave property of some Ishmaelites who took Joseph down to Egypt. Obviously, the brothers had to come up with a cover story as to what they were going to tell their father and the family concerning Joseph, who didn't return home with them. We learn about their cover story in Genesis 37:31. So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Now here is our first clue about what Yeshua did on the night of his retelling of the Passover story. In the Greek of John 13:26, the model or notion of dipping is related in meaning to the LXX Septuagint word for dipping in Genesis 37:31. In other words, the Greek terms are not exactly the same, but they do both express the same idea of dipping or immersion. The brothers' betrayal of Joseph brings forth a crafted cover story about his death when his brothers dipped Joseph's special tunic in the blood of a slaughtered goat, and then firmly stood by their story that Joseph was torn to pieces by a wild animal. Again, this is the one event that leads directly to centuries of national Hebrew enslavement and ultimately to the main Passover redemption story on the night of the 14th of Aviv, according to Exodus chapters 12 and 13. All of this is what I think might have been in the mind of Yeshua when he was teaching about the Passover as a prophetic picture of the betrayal of Messiah ben Joseph, or if you will, the anointed one, the son of Joseph, and his redemptive role. Essentially, the Passover story begins with a memory of what the brothers of Joseph did when they had a hand in kidnapping him and then had a hand in betraying him and their father by selling him into slavery into Egypt. And then finally, concocting a cover story to validate their betrayal when they dipped his special coat or tunic of colors into the blood of a slaughtered hairy one of the goats among them. Now we'll come back and continue this story and talk about this dipping thing going on here in just a moment. I'm Avi Ben-Mordechai, and this is Real Israel Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the second half of Real Israel Talk Radio. This is episode 126. Here is your host, Avi Ben Mordechai.
Welcome back to Real Israel Talk Radio. This is Avi Ben Mordechai. Let's continue where we left off with the reading of Genesis 37:31. The brothers of Joseph took Joseph's tunic. They killed a kid of the goats and dipped the tunic in the blood. Later, they brought the blood-stained coat to their father and said to him in Genesis 37:32-34, "We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?" And he, referring to Jacob, recognized it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son for many days. For Yeshua, I am convinced that the betrayal of Joseph and covering it up with a crafted story about his so-called unfortunate death by immersing his tunic of colors into the blood of a goat is the focus of Yeshua's reason why he dipped the morsel and gave it to Yehuda or Judas, explaining the words that Yeshua made concerning Judas or Yehuda. Quote, "He who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me." This could have suggested something that his disciples knew very well. In fact, even since their early childhood, as they grew up listening to the Passover story being retold in each of their families year after year. Let's take a closer look at the very old Jewish tradition of the Passover dipping ceremony. According to the Torah, maror, which refers to the term of bitterness, and the Passover lamb, they go together as a redemption theme. Read about it in Exodus 12, verse 8. "Then they shall eat the flesh of the lamb on that night, roasted in fire, with unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs." The Hebrew word there is maror, "and they shall eat him," referring to the lamb. To fulfill the divine instruction of eating the Passover lamb, the maror must also be on the table. Still, the law of the Torah concerning the bitter maror does not say anything about dipping or immersing it. So why did Yeshua do a late Second Temple period traditional Judean dipping ceremony of starting his Passover Seder by dipping a kazait, or a tiny olive-sized morsel of a bitter vegetable, such as parsley or celery, dipped into a red wine vinegary substance, which is called in Hebrew karpas. So let me put it this way. Maror refers to bitterness, but it's not considered an element of the Passover to be dipped. So why did Yeshua apparently do a traditional Judean dipping ceremony when it was not even written about in the Torah? And then, to make matters even more interesting, Yeshua gave the morsel of a dipped bitter herb to Judas or Yehuda, which then pointed to the betrayer's identity. So I ask, what's this all about? Permit me to repeat some of the details of what I said earlier. In Orthodox Jewish tradition, the Passover begins with a blessing over a cup of wine called Kiddush. Second, this is followed by a traditional washing of hands. Third, after this, the Passover Seder officially begins with a tiny nibble on a kazait, or an olive bulk, but no more, of what is called in Hebrew karpas. The karpas is then dipped in either salt water or, more traditionally, in a red wine vinegary substance. Contrast this to the Passover Torah law of maror in Exodus 12:22. Maror is something bitter tasting, such as horseradish today. At the Passover Seder, we eat maror with matzah, which is unleavened bread, and with the Passover lamb. I am saying that eating the bitter maror and dipping the bitter karpas are two different elements of the Passover Seder. So please, don't confuse the two ideas. Remember, the ceremony that kicks off the retelling of the Passover story is that of dipping the morsel of the bitter karpas. The eating of the bitter maror with matzah comes later. This said, I now want to establish two important points. Number one, there is in the Torah the Passover instruction of hyssop. It's found in Exodus 12:22. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop, symbolized by karpas, dip it in the blood that is in the basin, and strike the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. The second point, there is in Jewish tradition the Passover remembrance of Joseph's tunic of colors in Genesis 37:3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all of his children because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors, which in Hebrew is ketonet pasim. Now, this is really important. The term in Hebrew, pasim, pei, samech, yud, mem. That word in Hebrew refers to Joseph's fine linen coat of many colors. However, pasim is also a word that is very similar to a borrowed Aramaic Persian word called karpas, kaf, resh, pei, samech, meaning a fine linen fabric that was from the Persian court in the days of Queen Hadassah or Esther. And you can see that word in Esther 1:6. In the old days of the Jews in Persia, a link was established between the Hebrew word pasim, referring to Joseph's fine linen fabric coat, and the Aramaic word pas, referring to the Persian court's fine linen fabric. Later, both words came to symbolize and remember the bitterness of the cover story of Joseph's death and the deep pain and mourning that his father went through because of it. To remember the story, the Hebrew pasim and the Aramaic pas brought to mind a storyline connection of dipping and or the immersion of a fine linen fabric into a basin of something red and perhaps bitter, like blood. For the ancients among the Jews, what came to mind was the dipping of Joseph's coat in Genesis 37:31, and also the dipping of the hyssop in Exodus 12:22. So the ancient Jews linked the two words, pasim and pas, to remember it all at Passover. And this is the beauty of the Hebrew language, as it often gives us some latitude in wordplay. The link between pas, which is the fine fabric of Persia, and pasim, the fine fabric of Joseph's coat, is not the primary focus here. What is more important is that Yeshua appears to have used the connection between these two words as a perfect lesson to teach through the action of dipping a blood-red betrayal and what would come to him that night by Yehuda or Judas. His lesson clearly clarified the Passover story and revealed in the story the redemption concept of the Hebrew nation through the betrayal of another Joseph, that is, Messiah ben Joseph, who worked for the good of all Israel, as Joseph himself said to his brothers in Genesis 50, verse 20. But as for you, you meant evil against me. Elohim, or God, meant it for good, in order to bring it about as this day to save many people alive, or to life. Thus, the kidnapping and betrayal story of Joseph in Genesis 37 came to be associated with a national Passover redemption lesson from slavery to freedom through the concept of dipping. A redemption of good had to come out of the bad. And that was the lesson to teach our children. On that Tuesday night Passover with Yeshua and his disciples in that upper room, Yeshua's disciple Judas had come to be the dreaded betrayer of another Joseph, even though some at the time might have understood the deeper mystery that was being revealed to them in real time, as we learn from Luke 4:22. So all bore witness to him and marveled at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth. And they said, "Is this not Joseph's son?" Or in Hebrew, "Is this not Ben Yosef?" Again, in John 1:45, Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Yeshua of Nazareth, the son of Joseph," or in Hebrew, "Ben Yosef." The concept of Joseph showing up twice in Israelite history was certainly expected among the religious teachers of Yeshua's day, because they could see it in the prophetic spelling of the name Joseph in the Hebrew of Psalm 81, verse 6, which is verse 5 in English. Here is how Psalm 81, verse 6 could be translated into English. "The testimony of Yehoshaphat," again, Yehoshaphat, "he was established when he went up out of the land of Egypt, a language I did not know, I was listening." Typically, in Hebrew, Yosef is spelled Yud Vav Samech Fesofit. But here in Psalm 81, the name Yosef is given an extra letter, the Hebrew He, giving it a spelling of Yud He Vav Samech Fesofit, signifying a second breath of the life of Yosef, who was expected to return to Israel at some later prophetic time. In Psalm 81, the name Yosef, with its added Hebrew letter He, was then understood to mean Joseph twice! Exclamation point. Thus, the biblical tradition was passed down to all future generations that Yosef would indeed come again. But this generated a national question. Well, how will we know when he shows up again? The answer? He would use a kind of password to let the people know. The given password was said to be Pakad, Pei Kuf Dalid, Pakad, meaning a second Joseph would speak as the first Joseph by making his visitation for purposes of an inspection. The Jews expected that Elohim, or God, would surely visit them. And this idea circulated in Yeshua's day, as is attested by Yeshua, who said in Luke 19, 43-44, "They will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not know or accept or receive the time of your visitation." Here, the word visitation would be Pakad. The Joseph password link also included a kind of secondary password, just to make sure that they weren't getting things wrong, and that word is Allah, not Allah of Islam. This is Allah spelled Ein Lamed He. This means to ascend or to go up. So many expected an ascension or a rising of Joseph, followed by a descent or coming down of Joseph to complete the visitation or inspection process of the nation. So this is the likely understanding of the parable of national inspection in Luke 18, 6 through 8. Then Jehovah said, "Hear what the unjust judge said. Shall Elohim not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth?" Yeah, this is a visitation. And this would be fulfilled by the second Yosef, that is Messiah ben Yosef, or Messiah ben Joseph. A likely reason behind the statements recorded in John 6:42 and Acts 1:11. "Men of Galilee, why do you stand gazing up into heaven? This Yeshua, who was taken up from you into heaven, will so come in like manner," that is to descend, "as you saw him go into heaven." There you can see that idea of the Hebrew word Allah, to go up into heaven. And John 6:42, "And they said, is not this Yeshua, the son of Joseph," or Ben Yosef, "whose father and mother we know? How is it then that he says, I have come down from heaven?" So generations of Jewish religious scholars have studied about the expectation of a coming Messiah descended from the first Joseph, a coming messianic figure who is slain according to Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10. "And I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. Then they shall look upon me whom they pierced. Yes, they will mourn for him as one mourns for his only son, and grieve for him as one grieves for a firstborn." The slayer is unnamed, but the prophetic idea that links this to the coming of a second Joseph, that is, to Messiah, son of Joseph, is actually written about in prophecy according to Genesis 31, 34 through 35. "Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son for many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning. Thus his father wept for him." This depiction was so thought-provoking that it generated a lot of future Talmudic and rabbinic discussions, such as what is found in the Talmud at Sukkah 52a, among many other places. Quote, "Once the Messiah ben David saw Messiah ben Joseph, who was killed, he said to the Holy One, blessed be he, Master of the universe, I ask of you only life, that I will not suffer the same fate. The Holy One, blessed be he, says to him, life? Even before you stated this request, your father David already prophesied about you with regard to this matter precisely. As it is stated, he asked life of you. You gave it to him, even length of days, forever and ever." This teaching from Sukkah 52a is talking about the third day resurrection of Yeshua the Messiah. So concerning the Messiah, son of Joseph imagery, there is also a large stone inscription that was found among the Dead Sea Scrolls referred to as the Gabriel Revelation. Line 80 of the inscription was read by the well-known and well-respected Professor Israel Knoll. The inscription mentions a Messiah figure during the pre-Christian period, who will come and rise back to life in 3 days' time. Thus, the name of Joseph came to represent a kind of covenantal bridge between the family under the leadership of the patriarchs the nation under the leadership of Moses, and a new covenant people redeemed under the finished work of Messiah Yeshua. So Yeshua's words to his disciples on that Tuesday Passover night in Jerusalem of E14 set the stage for how Elohim would take redemptive action and visit his people to set them free from their slavery and transfer them from their forced servitude to freedom of life. And still, this redemption was not meant to be established in this world, as Yeshua said to the Roman governor Pilate in John 18:36. My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight, so that I should not be delivered to the Judeans. But now, my kingdom is not from here. Yehuda, or Judas, did not necessarily accept the divine program of redemption and salvation. Nope, he was looking for a different kind of redemption against the Roman oppression of his day. But Yeshua did not agree with that expectation in the mind of Yehuda. So when Judas, or Yehuda, was disappointed with Yeshua's final outcome, he turned against Yeshua and came to be his betrayer. And Yeshua was well aware of what he was thinking. So, as the Passover dipping episode concluded that night, the spiritual forces of Satan, or the opposer, entered Yehuda in full force. It was then that Yeshua said to Yehuda in John 13:27, "What you are doing, do it quickly." So that is the linked storyline between Yeshua, Judas, and the dipping episode going on that night in the Passover story on the 14th of Aviv, Tuesday night, in the first Hebrew Chodesh, or first Hebrew month, according to the Tzedok system of reckoning time, not according to the Judean reckoning of time. So to summarize all of this, the hand of Yehuda in Genesis chapter 37 leads the way in dipping the special coat or garment of Joseph into blood, versus the hand of Yehuda or Judas leading the way to dip the son of Joseph's special coat or garment of the Word made flesh into a basin of blood. The second point, the brothers of Joseph betray him and their father by selling Joseph to the Ishmaelites and the Edomites, versus a brother who betrays Messiah, the son of Joseph, by selling him to the Judeans, who act much like the descendants of the Ishmaelites and the descendants of Esau, clarified in Psalm 41, verse 9, or verse 10 in Hebrew. Even my own familiar friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. And the third point, the bitterness of a betrayal toward Joseph versus the bitterness of a betrayal toward the son of Joseph leads both groups into the topic of a bitterness of betrayal and a bitterness of slavery. So in closing, I wish to appeal to an article written for Jewish Bible Quarterly in 1999. The article is called, "Why Does the Seder Begin with Karpas?" From one perspective, it would have been inappropriate to begin the Seder on a joyous holiday of freedom with a reminder that the story started with a kidnapping that led to a descent into enslavement. If the children heard this story told explicitly, they might ask four very different questions. It was natural not to emphasize this part of the story and to focus instead on the redemption from Egypt in order to accomplish one of the primary objectives of the Seder, the education of the children. On our next podcast, we'll come back and we'll continue with part 14 in our series. I'm Avi Ben-Mordechai, and this is Real Israel Talk Radio.